Session number 9796.
Mr. Spearman, Reel 1. Where do you come from, Mr. Spearman?
I was born in London from an Irish family.
What did your father do for a living?
A saddler.
And how old were you when you left school?
14.
To do
I
what?
Couldn't get out of school quick enough. Very elementary school. To do what?
To God, do what kind of job?
God knows what. My mother actually put me into a departmental store where I acted as a dog's body for 12 months. And during that time, I toured all the shipping offices in London looking for an opening to join the Merchant Navy.
Why did you want to join that?
Because I wasn't suited to a life in a departmental store.
And did you get into the Merchant Navy?
I did.
How long were you in that for?
Well, until 2 weeks before the war, when I joined the army, when the war became imminent.
Why were you so keen to join up?
I wasn't keen to join up, actually. I was on the Carnarvon Castle, the passenger liner. And in August 1939, the boat had to go into dry dock. So we couldn't rejoin the ship for 3 weeks. And at that stage, 3 weeks was a lifetime to me, and I happened to be walking down Whitehall when I saw a big sign, come and join the army, and I walked in to see what it was about, and when I came out, I was in the Guards.
Because of sales talk, you mean?
Just a whim of the moment. The war was imminent. I felt, if you're at sea, you're not in the war. I felt more that if I joined the army, we could do something, you know.
Did you have any patriotic feeling about it?
Not really. I had an anti-feeling against Germany, that's all. Mm.
Why were you anti-Germany?
Well, because of their behaviour on the continent.
Because of the Hitler regime, you mean?
Oh, yes, of course. Poland and France and even before that. Well, yes, it's just the Nazism. Now, I was too young and too uneducated to really give it a lot of thought. And we lived in a flat in London. There was no spare room to stay at home and enjoy yourself. So, and when I got put to work in a departmental store for which I was unsuited, I was just looking around for something worthwhile to do.
How did you find the Guards training?
Oh, very extremely strict to the extreme. But I knew nothing else, and I think I took to it quite well.
In what way was it strict? Can you give some example?
Well, it was discipline in the extreme. When you went into barracks, if you ever got out of barracks, when you went out of barracks on foot or went into barracks on foot, you always had to salute as you went in and as you came out. You got chased uphill and down dale by the regimental sergeant majors. I mean, everything was disciplined. The bed in the morning had to be made. It was really a forming and a discipline being inserted on various types of people who joined the army, so that if in the case of war, you know, you were told to do something, you'd do it without thinking, without question. And this is what was behind such a strict discipline. And of course, as we all know, the Guards are still, and during the last war, were magnificent. What they did in the First World War, they were sent to the death in the thousands, and they did it, you know. I mean, war has changed now. You wouldn't get this sort of discipline. People wouldn't take this sort of discipline now. And my downfall in the Guards was that the regimental sergeant major, a fellow called Wood, Robinson, Snapper Robinson, regimental sergeant major in Windsor Barracks, had two daughters, one 18 and one 15, Horlicks, manufacturer of Horlicks, were in Slough, and they invited us to an evening, a dance. And while I was there, I met the young 15-year-old daughter of Snapper Robinson. I was only 17, she was 15. You didn't kiss, you didn't hold hands, nothing went on at all. We went to the dance. And when we came back in, I let her go through the gate first, and then I followed in after her. And then I just walked around to where she lived. I had a house in the barracks. Never laid a finger on her. Snapper Robinson came out of the mess, the sergeant's mess, drunk, and found me with his daughter, and they put me into the lockup for associating with women. So, I mean, talk about discipline, that was another thing, you know. Associating women, a hell of a case about it. You know, you wanted to court-martial me and everything, because I wasn't 18. This was before I was 18.
When you're allowed to take girls out?
Well, there was a... If you were in boy... When I joined before the war, this was a month before the war started, there were boy service in the army, in the guard. There was boy service and men's service. And if you were in boy service, you were not allowed to associate with women, apparently. And this is what he charged me. And he pressed it with all the vigour at his command because it happened to be his daughter, this girl. And I found out afterwards that she was courting a lieutenant in Windsor Barracks called Timothy Tufnell, who was a moneyed man. And if you go to be an officer in the Guards, of course, you had to be a moneyed man. I mean, you had to have quite a high private income. And if you go to Windsor today, you'll find the biggest estate agent in Windsor is called Tufnell's. So whether she ever married him or not, I don't know. She was only 15 at the time. It was only a casual affair, met her at the dance. So I was in charge of associated with women. So thereafter, I decided... And they wouldn't let me go to France. This was the thing. Because we weren't 18, we weren't allowed to go to France. And we were at a loose end. They made a demonstration platoon of us, and we went around the country locally, giving demonstrations, military demonstrations, and private demonstrations of drill. Because, as you know, the Guards are superb at drill. And this was getting me nowhere. And meanwhile, you know, Dunkirk was coming up, and that was coming to an end. So when they asked for volunteers then for command or parachute training, of course, I volunteered, and I got away.
You must have been very upset at the charge that was brought against you.
Well, I wasn't a womanizer, so I was upset a bit. But, I mean, it was, I look back on it, you know, with human air.
Was it easy to get into the commandos?
Well, I applied to get away from the Guards, and there was no hesitation in letting me go. And what that meant, joining the commandos, we were then posted to the Fort William area in Scotland. And it involved, if I can remember rightly, 7 weeks training, which was divided between two places. One was called Achnacarry, and the other was Achdaloo.
How do you spell the second place?
I can spell Achnacarry because it's in Lord Lovett's book. I've looked it up, which you probably know about. But Achdaloo, I presume, is A-C-H-D-E-L-I-E-A-U or something like that. Achdaloo. Achnacarry and Achdaloo. It's not a figment of my imagination, I don't think. It was... Anyhow, we had about 7 weeks training. And it was physical training to the extreme. Again, I refer to Lord Lovett because he was from Scotland. And in his book on Dieppe, he gives you some of the... killing exercises that were made up in order to assess and prepare the volunteers or the commanders for their different postings. And of course, the one thing that pervaded our mind when we were there was not to be returned to our units. They call it RTU. RTU became, all through the commando days, the one thing that would have been humility in the extreme was to be RTU'd, to be returned to your unit, because we all still belong to our mother regiment. I joined the Guards, and that was all through the war, my mother regiment. And I maintained the same number. And in Achnacarry and Achdaloo, the turnover there of people being returned to the units as not being fit for commando training, I can't give you a percentage, and I can't remember the percentage, but the percentage then was extremely high.
Do you think that the fact that you'd been in the Guards especially fitted you for going into the commandos?
Well, my own metabolism, you know, my own personality suited me, because I'd been in the Merchant Navy, got a little bit of taste for adventure, and then went into the Guards and got disciplined by them, you know. And I knew all about weapon training and all about drill and discipline. So certainly I was fitted for four units like the commandos, especially when Lovett joined later on, where he wanted there to be a lot of discipline in the commandos rather than to have a ragtag of beings who were always fighting it up and without discipline. You know, Lord Lovett particularly wanted to install discipline, which is right. So I was well suited in that way.
Had there been a certain lack of discipline before Lovett joined?
Well, not to me noticeably, but if you read Lovett's book, say, I'll keep referring to that, if you read Lovett's book, he would say they looked an indisciplined crowd, you know what I mean? And there is an inclination when something really tough comes up like that, they want people to go to France and do raids, you'll get any Tom, Dick and Harry, you know, disciplined or undisciplined, but it was most important for the War Office first to accept a bunch of people like that. And so the first necessity was for them to be disciplined. I knew of no indiscipline before that. But looking back on what he says, and my after experience in Malaya and places like that, in the emergency out there, Lovett was quite right. You had to have discipline, no matter how rough and tough the unit.
What happened to you next?
Well, after the 7 weeks, I progressed out of there, and then I was given the opportunity of either joining the commandos or the paratroopers. And I really wasn't worried where I went, but I knew that somebody who preceded me had gone to the commandos, so I said I'd go to the commandos. And I was actually posted number four commando, who were installed in Troon in Ayrshire. And I found when I got there was no barracks or anything like that. We were all put into civilian digs. We were nominated landladies and to go to. And we paid them a weekly sum of money and they gave us two meals a day. And we were there for, I think, 5 years or something. We were there for a long time anyway. It was always our base until maybe the latter part of the war. It was always our base. And the idea being that if you weren't in barracks, it wouldn't be so easy for the enemy to keep a tag on your movement or to, you know, realise when you were preparing for an operation.
What was the first operation you prepared for?
Well, I joined No. 4 Commander just as they came off the Lofoten Island raid. So when you ask me what was the first operation we prepared for is a very good question, because the whole time in my commando life we're always spent preparing for one operation or another. And I suppose, I don't know idea of percentages, but I suppose at least 40-50% of the operations we trained for in the end didn't come about for various reasons. It's well known. At that time it was quite early days, and I think the War Office had to be convinced that this sort of activity was worthwhile pursuing. And then it took a bit longer for then the people at the top to work out where the operation should take place and what type of operation. I suppose the Lofoten Island raid it didn't achieve very much, but it did show that you could go to Norway and do what you had to do and come back in one piece, as it were, you know. And that's when I joined, just after then. So I've no idea what was the first operation we prepared for, because we spent a whole time preparing for everything. We did force marches, we did swimming, we did night landings, we did assaults on from the sea up cliffs and on all sorts. In fact, if the idea of the commander was to do raids, we spent all our time training to do raids.
Did you speak to the chaps who came back from the Lofoten raid?
Oh, yes, because I was put in amongst them, yes.
Did you speak to them about the raid and what they felt about it?
Yeah, I can't remember that. When I read books now on these things, you know, I learnt more about what happened in the Four Commando by reading books than what I can't remember at that time. I was just 18. All I wanted to do was to get into action. That's why I left the Guard, because we couldn't go to France. And all I wanted to do was to get into action. And I knew there we would be in action, you know, sooner than later, you know.
But did they come back from the Lofoten Island raid full of enthusiasm for
what
they'd
done? It's a good question. I can understand you asking, but I can't remember. We didn't live in barracks. We lived in private houses and digs, and we only got together at 6 o'clock in the morning on the beach, and we immediately started working. Of course we had time to talk. We marched endlessly, speed marches, route marches, marches that never seemed to stop, and we had tons of time to talk. But I can't remember now, after 44 years, remembering for me to ask somebody, what the hell was it like? I can't remember doing that. I must have done it, but I can't remember.
What was the first raid that you actually went on?
With the Boulogne raid.
When was
Boulogne
that?
Boulogne in 1942. In fact, it was St. George's Day, I think, in 1942, which is... I made a note of it somewhere. I think it's on that thing I gave to you.
That's April 1942.
April 42. I haven't got the date here. April 42. I think it was the 1st of April. It's St. George's Day, I remember well. Well, and now, when I read any books about the commandos, and even Lord Lovett's book, I cannot see any very much reference to the Boulogne raid. Lovett refers to a small operation on the coast of France, which really didn't achieve very much, but gave us a lot of experience. And they met a patrol and something happened. But apart from that, he doesn't mention very much of it. Now, in my mind, it was a much bigger thing than that. It was a small raid. But I'll give you a few details now, which I've never read. And I sometimes wonder if I made them up. And I've often thought about it, but I'm sure I didn't. For the raid, I mean, we'd been training for the raid. I can't specifically remember what we were practicing, but what normally happens is they draw a map of a place on a coast, and you've no idea where the hell it is, but you get aerial photographs, so every man knows what he's got to do. The training and preparation, of course, is most important. Because if somebody else gets killed, you know what to do, and the whole thing then doesn't collapse. This was routine, we must have done it. But towards the raid time, we were put into Dover Castle. We were there for a week. And to our amazement, there were a hell of a lot of Canadians around this Dover fort, as well. And I suppose, with a bit of retrospect, the Commonwealth troops had never been in action since we were pushed out of France. They were dying to get into action. As a boost to the morale of people in Canada and America and here, they wanted the Canadians to be involved in a raid. So it turns out now that they were going to go on this raid with us. So I can't speak for the Canadians. All I can speak for is my own remembrance of this. We were in Dover Castle for a week, and then the night of the raid, we somehow got to sea. And I remember we were in three assault landing crafts, and we were as we got across the channel and got within a certain distance of France, we got into these assault landing craft, and there were three tied together behind a motor torpedo boat. That's how we did the run-in. Not right to the beach, but to within a short distance of the coast. I'll just repeat that. A motor torpedo boat towing three assault landing craft. They were tied together by hawsers. I never ever remember doing this again during the war, but this is how we definitely went into Boulogne this night. And of course, while we were still at sea, the chap in charge of the Navy, the torpedo boat, was the man in command of the operation until we landed, and then Lord Lovett would have taken over as far as we were concerned. And of course, at this stage, we had no idea. I had no idea where the Canadians were at all. I was just involved with the motor torpedo boat towing these three ALCs. And as we approached the land, I suppose a few miles away, the German artillery or machine guns picked us up, and they started letting rip at us with tracers, and shelling started. And of course, at my level, there was no discussion, but suddenly then they decided to abort the operation. This is not mentioned in Lovett's book or in any book I've read, but somebody decided to abort the operation, and they turned a U-turn round because they realised they knew we were coming. And I must say here that Dieppe was the same. Where it seemed to me that any time any of these Commonwealth troops, Canadians especially, got involved in an operation, they knew where they were going long before. We never knew where we were going. We never knew. All we knew, we saw a map of the area and didn't know it was in France or Holland or where it was. But every time Canadians were involved, there seemed to be a leakage. And Lovett says that in his book as well. And to my knowledge, anyway, you're back to the story. This motor torpedo turned round with these three boats towed behind. And what happened, as they put up speed to get away, the ropes tightened and the centre boat turned over. And all 30 men were drowned. We had Mae West on us. And as the middle boat turned over, because it was tight, you know, it was lifted out of the water, all the men in sight, they died. This is never mentioned anywhere.
Which boat were you in?
I can't remember. I was must have been either the first one or the last one. I can't remember which boat I was in. Anyway, we must have then got out of the AOCs when we got away from a certain distance from the coast, from the French coast, and got back into the big mothership, you know, the torpedo boat, and we landed back in Dover Castle, and then we went in again the next night.
Was there any attempt to save the men who were drowning?
I can't remember that detail. I remember that vividly there. I remember the coast picking us up. Anyway, the next night we went in again. I was most surprised at that. We were all terribly surprised that we should be going back, even though they'd picked us up the first night. And I suppose maybe they were going to get Canadian troops into action. They were determined that they should go ahead with it. And I'll just go back a bit. Because the Commonwealth troops were going to be in action for the first time since being thrown out of France, all the papers were already written the following morning, Canadians land in France. I remember that because when we came back and got out of the castle, I was shown these papers of Canadians land in France. I'm not saying they were published before we landed, the story must have been held. Anyway, we went back again the next night. And we were very surprised to be going back, and I can't remember if we replaced the 30 men or not. I can't remember that either. But we went back the second night anyway. And what the Germans did this time, and you'll not read this, I haven't read this in any book, but it's true. I've only had it confirm one thing, that when I went back to Dieppe this time, I spoke to some Navy people who were at Dieppe and who'd been with commanders on various operations. And I met a lieutenant there who remembered on the Boulogne raid a story I'm going to tell you now. So I got that much confirmation that I wasn't dreaming it. The second night went in, and instead of the Germans picking us up as we went in, they let us land. And we had motor torpedo boats taking us in. We had one. I can't remember going in the second night, how we went in. I can't remember being towed in with three in line the second night. But anyway, we landed, and there was hardly any trouble. But as soon as we landed, all hell let loose. And it appeared, and it turned out, I think, to be what actually happened. The Germans had a convoy of E-boats in the area, and the E-boats are like our motor torpedo boats, but they were much speedier. They weren't as good as our boat, but they were very fast. And they lay up and let the torpedo boats come in and land us from the AOCs. They came in as near as they could to protect the Royal Land. That was the normal. And as soon as we landed, all hell let loose. The E-boats, they made a half circle around the beach from a distance and penned in all the torpedo boats. And as soon as a certain point was reached, they opened up fire on these torpedo boats, and the torpedo boat couldn't get out of this circle. A great difficulty anyway. So we were on shore with the object of attacking a radar station, which was 3 miles inland. We got ashore on a perfect landing. We got wet going landing, but apart from that, there was no opposition, which was a great surprise after the night before. But you see, well, they were playing clever. As soon as we landed, all this shooting started out at sea.
Could you see that sea battle happening behind you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could hear the noise, and secondly, you could see the traces. The sky was full of traces. I mean, when you're shooting at night time, and every other bullet or a certain percentage, depending on the situation, is a tracer bullet, so that you can direct your fire. Otherwise, your fire isn't where your fire's going. So we saw all this at sea. And I don't know whether we realised it instantly, but that was what was happening. The U-boats The German E-boats surrounded the motor torpedo boats who tried to make a break for it, because they had to come back and pick it up. I mean, the landing craft had to come back and pick it up under the protection of the motor torpedo boats. And afterwards I found out that eventually, of course, our motor torpedo boats did eventually break out and did a hell of a battle with the E-boats. So apart from that, I don't know what happened at sea, but we went in on our job. I can't remember detail of going in. The one thing I can remember, I was with a chap called Joe Walsh, who incidentally only had one kidney. I'm diverging a little bit, but this chap Joe Walsh, he went through, a great commander fella, great soldier and everything. But having only one kidney, if you rode on his back with your fingertip, within a few minutes it would come up in a great red weal. Yes, the most extraordinary, and yet he went through all the war and survived. Anyhow, I was with this fella called Joe Walsh, and we were approaching this radar station. We were all working in penny packets. We had no idea what the rest of the M4 commander, how they were getting on or anything, because you're isolated, you're all individuals, you work in little packets, and you all have a job to do, and you know what you're doing, and you keep tied up with your neighbour and everything, you know. And we approached this radar station. We were amongst some wire at the time, and there was a slit trench in front of us, from which suddenly a German with his hat on, his helmet on, stood over us with his rifle and bayonet, and he lunged at me with his rifle and bayonet, because we were partial experts at unarmed combat, because it was something we always did, and it was one of the easiest movements to fend off the bayonet by putting your hand up with the rifle, grabbing the button, tipping him over. This is the idea, and it's still practiced, that sort of thing. Well, I'd always wanted to do it, we'd been trained for it, but when I lunged at the rifle, I missed the belly rifle. And when I lunged at the rifle, he also put pressure on his rifle to avert my thing. And because he was higher up than I was, I think that was why I missed the bayonet. And then his bayonet went through my equipment. We had grenades and explosives in our webbing equipment. The webbing is quite thick, and the belt is quite thick. It's doubly thick, the belt. But because of his momentum being up and coming down, the bayonet went through all these explosives or whatever it went through inside. It went right through the pouch, right through the belt, and it went into me. And I thought, God, I've had it. This is the end of it. And blood started, you know, coming through it all, you know. And I thought, well, what, do I scream or shout or what the hell do I do? Meanwhile, Joe had shot this fella I think he had a Sten gun at the time. It was either a Sten gun or a Tommy gun. And he shot him. And then after a few minutes, I realised I wasn't really hurt at all. I didn't feel anything, you know. And it was just, I can't remember too much detail then, but then a pre-prepared very light went off in the sky with a red star shell. And this was the order for everybody to get back to the beach. And of course, now I've still got a scar where this bayonet went into me, and it must have gone in about an inch and a half. One end of a bayonet is very thick and the other is very thin at the tip. And I thought it had gone right through me, but in actual fact it was only about an inch and a half went in. I've still got the scar, but it didn't do any damage, you know. But it made me feel a bit of a hero when we came back with all this blood swelling around there, and having been bayoneted by a German and got away with it, I was quite, in one way, pleased. But then this very light went up, and that was a strict order to get back to the beach with all speed. This was the pre-arrangement we had. Why we were called back to the beach, I don't know, but I'm quite sure it was connected with a sea battle, because we had to be picked up. And incidentally, when we went on a raid like that, we were given buttons to put on our jackets that we're wearing, and the buttons, some of them were compasses. Can't remember too much about it. You took the button off and it turned over and it became a compass. And you also had money, Dutch money or French money and things like that on you in case you got left behind on a raid.